/signs of cerebral malfunction evident, /secondary request under consideration. Message ends. Secondary request under consideration, I said, closing my eyes for a moment. 4 simple words, and likely the difference between life and death. Still, I'd take it. What other choice did I have? I tucked my copy of the primer into my belt and headed out. It was getting late when I finally found Grotha, the only person in the entire war group who could possibly understand what I was going through. More than that, he was likely the only soul who would greet me with something other than ridicule or fatal censure. I found him in the engineerium, sitting in a dark corner wearing nothing but a loin strap. He was gnawing on something long, red and stringy, some kind of scavenged meat by the look of it. Tattoos of snakes and spiders, each alight with stylized flame, covered his body, wrapped around his limbs and formed stylized patterns across his torso. Along the corridor on the other side of the room, blank-eyed servitors carried metal pails of incense blocks and fuel rods to the main propulsion chambers. The witless lumps didn't even glance in my direction, but just went about their business. Perhaps that was why Grotha had taken up residence here, hiding in plain sight. "Leanna Venderson," said the Saplar through a mouthful of blood and bone. He wiped blood from his lips, gave a shrill giggle, then hit the side of his head with the ball of his hand.
"It's Leanna Venderson."
"Yes, it's me," I said. "I've come to get us out of this."
"I have a plan too," he said.
He tapped his knuckles on the promethium tank to his right, his stripped-down flamer propped up against it.
"Burn the witch."
He laughed again, a sound soaked in madness and despair. "Not sure that's a good idea down here," I said.
"The more fire, the more chance I'll get her. This place will go up nice as you like."
"And you'll burn in the process."
"I'm not afraid of fire. It'll clean me."
His eyes glinted weirdly in the gloom.
"It'll burn me clean."
"It'll burn you to death, Grotha," I said. "And if it catches the engines, it might kill the rest of us too." He shrugged and pulled a weird, frog-eyed face. "What do I care?" "There's got to be another way," I said. "Look, I know a place where we can hide out. It's even safer than this. I made a circle of aqua sanctus around my bunk, like a ritual circle. I think it keeps that thing at bay."
"Nothing keeps her at bay."
"Trust me. It came for me last night, and I'm here, aren't I?"
"Then it wasn't the same thing."
I reached into my fatigues, pulled out Doyler's picture, and showed it to him. He scrabbled back, his face drained of all colour.
"Put it away,"
he said, half pleading.
"I don't want it."
I folded the charcoal sketch once more and tucked it away. Grotha seemed to rally a little.
"She's keeping you for last of all," he said.
He smiled nastily, sharp little teeth still smeared with blood.
"That's why you're still alive."
I felt something tickle my spine then. Fingers of cold terror playing up my vertebrae and across the nape of my neck. He was right, and some part of me knew it.
"Bullets won't work," he said. "Blades won't work. Even your aqua sanctus won't work. No, mamselle, it won't. No good against her. But fire."
He tapped the tank again.
"Fire's always good. Burn her back to the warp."
I grimaced. Part of me wanted to believe him about the fire. The Adeptus Sororitas used flamers as one of their holy trinity of weapons, and they dealt with the most diabolic threats in the Imperium. Maybe there was something to his claim. "Right, fine." I stretched out a hand. "Fight the cold grave with the fires of war. I'll requisition a flamer, or just steal one, I don't know. back to back, covering each other, we can hold anything at bay.
Yeah, now you're seeing it,
he said.
Fire fixes everything.
His smile was like a split wound, and he took my hand, allowing me to help him up. Then his eyes went wide, and his forearm broke right in front of me with a gristly crack. A shard of red slicked bone jutted up, barely 3 inches from my chin. I recoiled hard, and he screamed in my face.
No,
I managed. I grabbed him by the shoulder and pulled hard, flinging him behind me.
Get back! Run!
He scrabbled away, then launched himself sideways, tucking his broken arm close to his chest. He scooped up his flamer, pulled its safety lever, and let fly a blast of searing promethium fire at something I couldn't see. Too close. I felt incendiary heat kiss my skin. The unmistakable scent of smouldering hair was horribly thick in my nostrils as I staggered backwards.
Burn!
Screamed Grutha, staring at thin air as he squeezed out another blast of roaring flame.
Burn, you bloody abomination!
Flames licked across the walls, rippling upwards from blue to orange. The heat was unbearable. Klaxons roared from every corner of the room, servitors lumbering around with canteens of dirty water as they enacted emergency fire protocols. I looked back at Grutha. He screamed and swept the flame around in a searing, billowing arc. I hit the deck, the flames cascading overhead. Grutha stumbled backwards, desperate to catch the invisible apparition in his flames. Sliding backwards as best I could, I looked up to see him knocked sideways as if by a charging bulgrin. He slammed into one of the walls that was already on fire, and liquid flame spattered across his shoulder and neck. His flesh burned, bubbled and roasted, filling the old with the scent of cooking human flesh. It wasn't the first time I'd smelled it, and it made my gut churn with a potent mixture of hunger and revulsion. Grutha screamed and held out his wounded arm as if to ward something off. His fingers twisted this way and that, snapping like kindling. 1, 2, 3 digits bulged and bent double on themselves, breaking with a horrible series of pops to form odd little half spirals. The man's screams doubled in intensity. Blood drizzled from the jutting spikes of his radius and ulna. I shook myself, stumbling back, but I couldn't look away. Grutha was raised from the ground by an invisible force, his left leg bent sidelong, jerking about in spasmodic motion as if in the jaws of a crocodile. Then it snapped at the thigh with a crack like a rifle retort. 2 more jagged spars of bone burst through his fatigues, each ringed with bright red blood. The scent of it filtered through my resp, mingling with the smell of promethium and burning flesh, to make me gag in horror and disgust. Grutha's other leg was forced up against his chest, as if he was kicking high. It was suddenly levered sideways to snap in the middle, the kneecap and cartilage torn apart to leave his lower leg dangling by a thin sleeve of tattooed skin. A moment later, his undamaged arm, finger still tight on the flamer's trigger, snapped like a dry branch, bone jutting out of the back of his elbow to gouge a deep gash across his cheek. Fire roared around me, the shimmering flame obscuring Grutha from view as he screamed over and over again. My feet, still bare in the name of stealth, were touched by a licking tongue of flame. I jumped back with a yelp, but I still couldn't take my eyes off the Savlar getting broken to pieces in front of me. I felt hot air catching my lungs. Suddenly the spell was broken. The Engineerium was alight, flickering an orange-red like some primitive's idea of purgatory. The stink of burning human meat was thick. If I didn't get out of here, I would die of suffocation, or, if Grutha's promethium cylinder caught first, be torn apart by the subsequent explosion. I scrambled to my feet and ran back the way I had come, leaping over a pool of liquid fire before ducking under a servitor's yoke and slamming into the wall on the other side of it. A primal fear drove me on, my bare feet pounding across the rough metal grills of the engine deck. My soles were slowly being cut to ribbons, but I didn't feel anything. Every fibre of my being was screaming at me to get away. Grutha's scream still rang loud behind me as he burned alive. too broken and splintered to escape the flames of his own making. I made it all the way back to my outsize brig without being seen. I suppose the rank and file were busy obeying their fire-in-transit protocols. Given the fact the klaxons had ceased, the servitors had likely been reinforced by their tech priest masters, and together they had got the blaze under control. With my feet in such a state, it's almost certain I left bloody footprints leading back to the brig. By this point, I was numb to the idea of the voidsman coming for me. I could use the company. After the last few encounters, death by beating seemed preferable to what was waiting for me. But I was too stubborn to truly give up. I always have been. It's how I rose through the ranks, even if I'd had to climb over the bodies of people I'd betrayed to get there. When the thump of marching feet came from the end of the corridor, rhythmic and methodical, my heart leapt with fierce elation. Too slow and heavy to be voidsman. "Yes," I said. "Yes, you're going to see what you get now. See what you get."
"Are you addressing me, Field Commander First Class Leanna Venderson?"
"Yuki, it is you. Thank the God Emperor." I ventured out of my cell, emboldened. There she was, my petite engine seer friend in her deep red tech priest regalia. She was flanked by four heavy servitors. Their left arms had been surgically removed, replaced with giant, boxy, heavy bolters. Together they had enough firepower to slaughter a herd of stampeding groks.
"You brought them?"
"Only on the understanding I will be able to record clear vid capture of a Class Alpha Warpgeist within the next 16 hours.
"Oh, you'll get your footage," I said. "Station one servitor at each of the cardinal points of this circle, please." She didn't ask why. She just got right to it. Throne above, how I love that woman. The gun servitors lumbered into place, guided by Yuki's electronic imperatives. Their slack-jawed expressions reminded me of comatose shell-shock victims. But their bionic eyes were in constant motion, whirring and recalibrating as they covered a quadrant of the cell each. Yuki fussed and tinkered with their exact orientation, chanting hymns of electro-compliance as she made final adjustments.
"All quadrants covered with a 3.5% overlap," she said. "A precaution in case of turbulence."
"And the ammunition?" I asked, climbing onto the cot and folding my legs under me. "Do you have it?"
"I do," she said.
She opened a cavernous pocket of her Hessian robes, took out an ammo case and carefully placed 2 dozen bolt shells on the end of the cot. Each was the thickness of my forearm, a small artillery projectile inscribed with tiny letters. I picked one up. The text had been fastidiously inscribed by Yuki's dexterous fingers. "Sanctus Imperialis Dominatus." The engine seer made a clicking bird of disapproval, and I put it back down. She moved it ever so slightly to the left and went back to her work. As she placed the bolt shells, I took out my aspergillum and transferred some aqua sanctus to the tip of each. The fluid ran down in little streams to fill the words of faith that Yuki had inscribed in them. "I saw this done on Herod once," I said. "At the time, I thought it was ridiculous. Now I'm not so sure."
"Rituals must be observed," said Yuki, as if to a simpleton. "Or else, how will the machine spirits be appeased?"
"How indeed," I said. I had never really understood the priesthood of Mars. Their cold, dead-eyed servitors had always creeped me out, with their unthinking obedience and slack, pale flesh. But so long as the tech priests kept the wider war machine in good working order, so long as their adherence to the odd cult gave us reliable firepower, none of us Nocti really cared how they did it. "These things can see in several different spectrums, right? Their eyes look a lot like yours."
"They have been retrofitted to perceive infrared and electromagnetic spectrums, as well as auto-psychic disturbances, provided their neural link is not severed. It is an extrapolation of my own augmentary bioware.
I nodded sagely, as if I understood every word.
I would remind you of the importance that this fact remains off record, said Yuki. Such advanced bionics are not standard issue for one of engine seer rank, let alone their servitors.
Of course, I said. I only mention it because she... because the warp entity might not be perceivable on the standard wavelengths. You'll have to scan through the filters until you get a bead.
Oh, I will not be present during the investigation.
You won't?
No, Field Commander. I do not wish to be the subject of a mind wipe in the event of a full-scale empiric phenomenon. It would adversely affect my chances of progress in the machine cult.
Mind wipe. Great.
In the extremely unlikely event you survive a warp manifestation and are thence modified into a servitor, I will do my best to ensure you are regularly oiled.
I nodded, feeling a little like my heart had just fallen into my lap. Right. Thanks, Yuki.
Units Gamma Ferenth, Beta Nonagon, Mu Zender Thren, and Octos 7 Endi will keep you company.
She loaded the aqua-blessed shells into the servitor's heavy bolter breeches one by one.
I have keyed them to your vocal patterns over the course of our exchanges over the last 12.2 minutes, and given you authority to target, but not to redeploy. I have no doubt they will make for lively conversationalists. They may even sing to you as an accomplished quartet. End falsehood.
There she was, my old friend behind that hypersteel facade. No one can deadpan a joke like a tech priest. Thank you for all this, Yuki. I can't tell you how much this means to me.
All knowledge is power, she said. If I can add significant data on the warp crisis to my order's records, the contribution will not go unnoticed.
She fixed me with her green eye, the one that was still recognizably human, and walked over to me.
Besides, I like you.
She took out a folded environment suit from beneath her heavy robes, put it on the bunk, and motioned for me to hold out my hands. I followed suit, and she carefully placed a pair of synth wax muffler plugs into my cupped hands. They were the type used by the engine seers in weapons testing facilities. She put the folded staff pick I had requested on top, and placed a sealed flask of liquid on the bunk. Then she made the sign of the holy cog, turned, and left without another word. Another 2 hours crawled past. I'd unscrewed the top of the flask Yuki had given me, hoping for more water, and found something better. Sweet-smelling Noctai liquor. If I made it through the night and somehow rode all this out, I would pay her back 3 times over. The sheer, unnatural bulk of the combat servitors was daunting after so long alone in the cell. They made me feel on edge, especially whenever I looked closely at the inflamed and puggered flesh around their bionic enhancements. I was very glad they were facing outwards, to be honest, because me in their gaze would have made me feel distinctly uneasy. What a fate, to become one of those things, permanently enthralled to the Adeptus Mechanicus that made you that way. It helped me to think of them as weapons, as my weapons at that. After a while, I got used to them. The weighty muscularity of the servitors and the smell of freshly oiled guns at least gave some sense of security. Anything that came for me would be met by a thunderous bombardment of explosive, mass-reactive rounds, each still wet with aqua sanctus. I knew there was a chance the combination of holy blessing and battle-grade firepower might not work against that emperor-damned apparition in the final reckoning. But at this point, it was the best I could hope for. I donned the hostile environment suit that Yuki had left me, wondering what reason she had for leaving it to me, until I realised it was sewn with flak weave over the torso. It was likely provided to protect against the shrapnel of my own firepower, rather than to shield me against anything else. I gathered the blankets around me, more as a ritual than anything else, and waited. The scratches on my calf and shoulder felt fever hot. I spread a little aqua sanctus on them, and the feeling subsided. It wasn't that long before I heard sounds in the corridor. Tap, 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 scratch. Tap, 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 scratch. I put them out of my mind, focusing on the verses of the ecclesiarchal primer that seemed best for an impromptu exorcism. They didn't recede for long, though. Just enough to make me feel they had stopped altogether, and then they would start again. It was driving me slowly towards the edge, towards the brink of doing something stupid. "Come out, then," I shouted. "Come out and we'll see how clever you are." I listened again. This time I heard the sound of footsteps. Lots of them, and moving fast. With a sense of sudden fear, I recognised the heavy boots of voidsmen, punctuated by the click of dress uniform heels. "Stand down," I said quietly. My cyborg guardians slumped, pointing their heavy bolters diagonally downwards with a whir of servo motors. I sat bolt upright on my cot, held my copy of the ecclesiarchal primer high, and began to read as if I had not a care in the stars. One of the voidsmen came round the side of the cell. I cast him a glance. He was a starch-uniformed busybody with a white moustache and a brass-chased lasgun that he was pointing right at me.
"Found her, Adjutant Prime," he said,
his impeccable accent the clipped syllables of a navy soul born and bred. Another two voidsmen came up behind him, one a tall male with infra-goggles, the other a female with a shaved head and a hare-lip.
"And what in Throne's name are these?"
he asked. "Gun servitors, Voidsman Zant," I said. He looked taken aback that I knew his name, but it was right there on his fancy gold-braided epaulette. "They are on loan from the Tech Priests, and until this judiciary disaster is concluded to my satisfaction, they will remain that way." My tone, combined with the sight of four heavy combat servitors, took the bluster out of Zant's sails. He looked sidelong at someone down the corridor, then moved along the front of the cell, his fellow voidsman going with him. Threnard took his place a moment later, his uniform impeccable, but for two thin crescents of darkness under his arms. He too was carrying an ornate lasgun. He lowered it just a little when he saw that my servitors were currently inactive, and that I had nothing more dangerous in my hands than a water flask and a book.
"Resourceful as ever, Field Commander Venderson," he said. "Don't call her that," came a bombastic roar from down the corridor. It was a full voice of that predatory joy that certain men take in giving vent to their anger. I knew it only too well. Bulvac came around the corner, his puffy, balding head flushed from chin to scalp. "She's no part of the Astra Militarum, Threnard. Not any longer."
"I don't know about that," I replied. "I think I have till false dawn, at least."
"You will be court-martialed before the night is over," said Bulvat, eyes wide in that huffing, breathless slab of a face. "I will devise a fitting punishment for your murder of Thorn and those Savlar men. You can be sure of that."
I yawned. "Perhaps a bit less time contemplating punishments and a bit more time in Fizz might do you good," I said. "I haven't murdered anyone, save for perhaps a few hundred enemies of the Imperium. Still, I'm sure you found more than enough evidence to satisfy your bloodlust."
"The footprints that led here from the Engineerium would have been damning enough on their own," said Threnard. "But I have a dossier ready in case more is needed." "Private Grotha's dead, and we know you did it," said Bulvat. "Same modus as Thorn, Vernid, and Jakobsen, eh? Stronger than you look, you heretic scum."
"What on terror are you talking about?"
"You were seen near the Equestrium on the night of Jakobsen's death," said Threnard. and near Doyler's berth on the morning of his suicide.
He knew what you were going to do to him, said Bulvat. Took the coward's path rather than let you torture him.
Utter nonsense. He was spooked. Warp-touched, perhaps. I had nothing to do with it.
Several cook hands placed you in the kitchens immediately before the galley massacre, said Threnard, ploughing on regardless. Enoch Whitemane said your alibi was a complete fabrication.
The little bastard's still alive?
Yes, but despite your best efforts, said Bulvat. Not quite as adept at navigating the liar's maze as you thought, are you?
Oh, for the love of holy terror! I really hoped this wasn't about me beating him at Hexagrammon that time. Surely even Bulvat wasn't that monstrous an egomaniac.
And what are these for?
Asked Threnard, waving a long finger at the servitors. He looked wary, but impressed, like a man eyeing a pack of prize attack canids.
They look to me like unsanctioned use of Mechanicus resources. I am sure Engine Seer Beta Dara's superiors will be very interested to hear of this.
These are my new friends. I am expecting a visitor later tonight. Threnard made an exaggerated expression of confusion.
Later tonight? I don't think you understand. You are coming with us.
No, I really don't think I am. Target close. The servitors lurched to life, dead-eyed stares and slack jaws turning to face Bulvat and his posse. Their heavy bolters made a deep clung-chack noise in perfect unison. I grinned then, despite myself. I could feel the mania behind my eyes, but I didn't care.
You must come with us, Lyanna, sighed Threnard. Cease all this posturing, or it will go worse for you.
He motioned to the voidsman with the scalp cut, and she stepped forwards, plasteel manacles held in either hand. May I finish my chapter first? I held up the ecclesiarchal primer. Blessed is he that meditates upon the word of the holy texts. Funny how it's always he, don't you think? Bulvat bared his teeth in something that he probably imagined was a snarl of triumph.
If you think you can wriggle out of what's coming to you with a paper-thin conversion to the Imperial faith, you are sorely mistaken. When we get to the next war zone, you will be formally executed. In the meantime, you will be bound in chains and publicly flogged every dusk and false dawn. I will ensure it is I who wields the whip.
Over the last few days, I said, sipping the sweet Noctai liquor Yuki had left for me. I have seen things that make you seem not intimidating, but ridiculous. You are an angry little boy, playing at being a military man, all dressed up in his famous father's uniform. It doesn't fit you nearly as well as you think.
That's enough, roared Bulvat. Arrest her immediately.
The three voidsmen started forwards, then hesitated as the servitors' heavy bolters took direct beads on their chests. I pushed Yuki's earplugs home, one after another.
For throne's sake!
Bulvat grabbed Threnard's ornate lasgun, ripped it from his grip and pointed it at me, tucking it against his shoulder as he walked forwards. Fire! I said. Then the world erupted into thunder and death. A few seconds later, I was the only person left alive in the Guidance's brig. Well, not strictly true, but I don't really count the servitors in that. Those poor bastards aren't alive in any sense that matters, no more than a servo skull or an antique bolter is alive. But I tell you what, they work just fine. Everyone in Bulvat's arrest group had been blown to pieces in a matter of 4 short seconds. I'm not the squeamish type, but I could only glance at the chamber outside the brig for short periods at a time. It looked like a demolition charge had gone off in an abattoir. Rib cages and opened guts had spilled dark tangles of meat. Disembodied heads and severed hands were strewn like litter amongst lakes of blood and sloughs of shiny red organs.
flaps of skin mingled with gore-slicked cloth, in places all but indistinguishable. Here and there were the hard edges of lasguns or pieces of field equipment, but the rest was organic ruin. It stank to high heaven. Thrown, but they're right when they say that heavy bolters can make a real mess. My ears were still ringing, even with my Mechanicus-grade plugs. The voidsmen hadn't really had a chance. They got off a few good shots. Two of the servitors had stinking red holes in their torsos, and one of the others had taken a hit in the thigh. But not one of them had moved, or so much as groaned, come to that. They'd just got on with the job, thudding out explosive shells in a pitiless, murderous firestorm, until nothing in their arc of fire was moving. Then they had wordlessly resumed their original positions and gone back to their silent vigil. Other than raising my ecclesiarchal primer to shield my face from shrapnel, I hadn't moved throughout. Bits of bone and meat had splattered across me when one of the voidsmen got close, but the hazard suit kept the organic shrapnel from doing anything other than stinging a little. I was unscathed, in body at least. The smell of the carnage was getting to me, so I took the plugs out from my ears and delicately inserted them into my nostrils instead. Much better. Not quite what Yuki had in mind, I don't think, when she lent me her cyborg friends. But by this point I was numb to the horrors of the last few days. In fact, if anything, I felt a sense of fierce elation. I could feel it bubbling up inside me, threatening to burst out as a giddy laugh that would never end. Then I noticed the corpse of one of the voidsmen. The scalp-cut girl had its eyes looking roughly in my direction. They were wide open, as if in profound surprise. I saw myself in her, and it sobered me. Oh, a pox on it all! It was them or me! I turned my back on that grisly tableau, forced myself to focus on my prayer book, and waited for the real threat to come home. It was some time later when Maricel Thorne's ghost came for me. After another painstaking iteration of my Aqua Sanctus ritual, I climbed back on the cot and muttered the litany of the lost a few times just for good measure. I was so exhausted by the events of the last few days, I worried I was going to fall asleep. But my nerves were so shredded, I felt more awake than I'd ever been before. No way was I going to nod off, only to wake up with that thing looming over me like a death witch over a newborn's cot. I unfolded the staff pict Yuki had given me along with the earplugs. The official pict of Maricel Thorne, the one that they had used at her burial. In that grainy image she was standing as tall as she could, given her slight frame. Her uniform was impeccable, and there was a trace of idealism in the set of her jaw. She seemed so young in that depiction. It made me feel bad to look at it. A queasy feeling right in my stomach. My scratches were itching again, so I dabbed a little more Aqua Sanctus on them and fought to control my breathing. Only a few drops left. The minutes stretched into hours. I could feel the stress sweat all over my back and soaking my armpits. The environment suit was unbearably stifling, and I had to lose the collar as well as the gloves to stop myself from being cooked in it. After a while, I got out the charcoal picture I'd moved from Doyla's berth and compared it against the photo cell. I forced myself to look at the drawing, to get used to the sight of it. Emperor knew the image was burned into my mind already. Putting aside the horribly broken limbs, the sketch was a good fit for the official pict. Doyle had a real talent. He'd even got the curve of those horribly long, dirt-yellowed fingernails right in his drawing. I recalled the image of one of those talons slithering out of my chest and coming towards my lips with startling vividness. I was reminded of cadaver class in Medicaid training and being a little freaked out by the fact that even when a person is dead, their nails and hair keep growing, getting longer and longer inside their coffin until they curl back on themselves. It was her, all right, in the drawing. Maricel Thorne. and with Grotha burned alive. She was coming for me. I must have run through every possible scenario in my head 100 times over. A lot of them involved more voidsmen making their way down into the brig, finding the crimson ruins spread across the corridor opposite, then yanking me away to something they thought as a safe place, thereby dooming me in the process. Some of the waking dreams had Yuki arriving at gunpoint, her vox imperative powering down the combat servitors, so that I was matched against 6 well-armed killers with nothing but a heavy book. They were the best-case scenarios, really. Some ended with the corpses of the voidsmen coming to life, blank-eyed and hateful. In one vivid imagining, Threnard and Bolvat somehow stitched themselves together, stumbling forwards like a terrifying patchwork golem to tear me limb from limb. The worst of them started with her, coming out from the shadows on the wall of the cell, then walking right through my defences. Sometimes she rose right up from the shadow of the bed itself, her matted and earth-soiled scalp cresting the edge of the cot, then rising to reveal the mouldering features beneath. Some of them ended with her breaking me into 12 pieces before sending my soul screaming into the warp. In one scenario, she opened a maw of jagged teeth and began to eat. The one scenario I'd neglected to factor in. Well, that was the one that happened. Halfway through the night, I was lying on my side, trying to conjure images of golden sands and found objects purely to give my fevered mind a break from the horrors running through it. I heard her coming then, or I thought I did. Tap, 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 screech. I sat bolt upright, peering hard at each of the walls in turn. There were shadows there, but none of them were moving. The servitors were still in sentry mode, but not one of them had so much as twitched. The noise came again, this time from behind me. Tap, 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 screech. Expecting to feel corpse nails scraping the back of my neck, I turned suddenly, but there was nothing there. Tap, 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 screech. Not the sound of fingernails down splintered driftwood. More like one set of toenails clicking on the stone floor, then others dragging behind. A ghost on broken limbs. Liana! I clutched my ecclesiarchal primer so hard it buckled in my hands, and I stared every which way, but I couldn't see a damn thing to direct my firepower at. The shadows were all straight and unmoving, and my circle of aqua sanctus was intact. Then, on some nameless instinct, I looked up. She was coming through the ceiling. Lank black hair stretched down around the face of a half-rotten corpse. The creature emerged with horrible slowness from an oil-black slick of shadow, transfixing me with a paralysis of pure dread. I saw a wrinkled white forehead, then sunken, milky eyes, bloodshot at the edges and dotted with tiny hollow pupils that stared their black hatred into my soul. She had a ghoul's mouth, teeth so broken and wrong that some of them pierced her parchment dry lips. Long white arms dangled towards me. Each jerky motion was more sickening than the last, as the broken limbs bent awkwardly back and forth, cracking and grinding in ways that should never have been possible. Rotten black blood spattered on my face and hands, a trickle of droplets leaking from each of her shattered bone spurs. I gabbled meaninglessly, stricken with terror, as 10 preposterously long fingernails came down as if to cup my face. One shattered leg jerked from the shadow on the ceiling as she crawled out of nothingness, the skin of her bare thigh liver-spotted and sallow. Fire! I choked out. Fire! Close!
The gun servitors, oblivious, continued to stare at their prospective walls. Bereft of targets, they did nothing. Then she peeled herself out from the folding shadows of the ceiling like some hideous insect emerging from a chrysalis and dropped down to fall across me. I saw her rotting face inches from mine, heard a soil-choked gurgle as her corpse weight pressed down. Those dirt-encrusted fingernails slashed through my hazard suit. Though they looked fragile, they were as strong as titanium knives and dug hard into my flesh. I tried to scream, but nothing came out. I convulsed, frothing at the mouth with raw panic. She raked my ribs and slashed the muscles of my arms and shoulders to ribbons. Skin like milk-white parchment buckled over a framework of broken bone as she reached right back, splintered arms rotating unnaturally, and ran her claws down the length of my legs. Lines of fire burned everywhere across my body. The pain was becoming indescribable, as if fissures filled with fire and acid were opening all over me. I still couldn't move. She was cutting faster and faster now, thrashing almost, making the horrible rasping noise of a corpse exhaling the last of the air in its lungs. She turned again, and her lank wet hair slapped at the sides of my face. Her fingernails gouged and raked at the sides of my neck, her dead eyes locked onto mine all the while. I saw nothing there but hate and madness. The pain reached a racking crescendo. Those glinting black pupils expanded to fill my entire world, and I was gone. I woke at false dawn with a lurch, staggering from my cot and rebounding from the broad back of one of the combat servitors. It pivoted, trying to turn its heavy bolter on me. "No," I said, holding out my hands. "Stand down! Stand down!" The servitor made a stricken, whirring noise and turned back to the wall. "Oh, Terra," I panted. "Oh, holy throne above! God, Emperor, thank you for sparing me!" I clutched at my heart, feeling like I was on the brink of just dying of shock then and there, as the events of the last 24 hours raced through my mind. I checked my body for the long, deep nail marks I was convinced had torn me to ribbons from head to toe. Thank all that is holy, I found no more than the ones on my calf and shoulder. Even they had faded. Still intact, still alive, despite the terrors of the night, it was more than I could say for the people that really had visited me. I looked over at the horrible, stinking morass of corpse remnants across the way, and felt my gorge rise. Already bilge flies were beginning to gather. I needed a plan, and fast. I paced up and down, desperate for a piss, but not wanting to use the basin to relieve myself in front of the servitors. The idea of those dead eyes watching gormlessly gave me the shivers. Even after all that had happened, not sure anyone smaller than Rocco Crodden could have used the plus-sized refuse bowl in the corner of the outsized cell without falling in either. And there it was. A plan, or the beginnings of one, unfolded in my mind. "Found you, you little shit!" Enoch Whitemane was outside the Fizz Hall, writing something on a tiny parchment he had pinned up against a wall. As he turned, I pointed my lasgun, well, Threnard's lasgun, right at his smug, mutton-chop-wearing face. I'd taken the liberty of attaching the bayonet.
"Field Commander Venderson, good evening. I wondered when I would see you again."
The little swine didn't miss a beat, nor flinch from the 2-foot length of steel with its tip hovering between his eyes.
"I see you have adopted my habit of going barefoot."
"I have for now," I said. "Been moving about this ship slow and quiet, like a geist, you might say." He shuddered, just a little. It was enough. You didn't stick around for long when your Savlar pals got theirs back in the galley. I'm a rattling, he said, his stubby arms spread wide. We know when to run. How went the clean-up? Profitable enough. I had many a compliment on my meat bread. He smiled nastily, seeing if I would take the bait. Surprised you got that fat oaf Crodden into the machine without breaking it. He shrugged. It was a small tell, but nonetheless the one I wanted to see. Unless his body is still in your meat locker, of course. Shame to waste all those expensive bionics, right? Something like that, he said. We stared at each other for a long moment. They say you've acquired quite a taste for mutilating Savlar bodies yourself, said Enoch. You'll be surprised to hear it was Crodden all along, I said. He frowned. Care to elaborate? Can all this really be laid at my door? Do I look like the sort of person that could snap a man's limbs like they were twigs? Not even I could down six of Savlar's dirtiest fighters in the dark. Enoch inclined his head, pushing the tip of the bayonet to one side. You'd be surprised what people will believe, and even the biggest lies, often enough repeated, it still smells like a smokescreen. I interrupted, bringing the bayonet back to hover between his eyes. And I have a far more believable lie ready to go. This Crodden angle, he said. Won't it all be a little irrelevant when Bulvac catches up with you? Bulvac and Threnard are dead, I said. What? No. Oh, yes. As are the three voidsmen they had with them as military arbitrators. If you want to make use of them, you'll need a shovel and a bucket. The ship shuddered slightly, and at the end of the corridor, klaxons sounded. The guidance was only 3 hours from warp translation. I had to try hard not to leap into the air with joy. Damnation, said Enoch. That changes things. Afraid so. He whistled long and low. And makes you the ranking officer. Yes, indeed. I smiled thinly. You work for me now, Enoch. And you can start by spreading the unvarnished truth that we're about to make up. Roger that, Field Commander, he said, wiping his hands on his hips. No problems with that at all. Good, I said. Now listen carefully. You and I have work to do. It took a lot of effort and the impromptu hijack of a mag hauler trolley. But White Mane and I got Crodden's body from the galley meat locker and down into the outsized brig without being seen. With most of the crew holed up in their berths ready for the warp translation, there weren't that many prying eyes to avoid. We swung by the Armorium and picked up a couple of heavy bolters too, the better to give Crodden a weapon that could have killed Bulvac and his party once Yuki had withdrawn her servitors from the scene. By the time the translation was over and we were all officially allowed back out of our berths, the big Savlar would have thawed out well enough and his cadaver was still in pretty good shape. The rattling cook's deep freeze had stopped Crodden's body from rotting since the night of the massacre. When we reached the brig, I put a hole in his chest with one of the voidsman's lasguns and arranged the heavy bolters strung on their bulky straps around his neck. The whole charade wouldn't fool a determined investigator, but with Threnard gone, I doubt anyone cared enough to challenge the narrative we were putting in place. He looked a lot more like a mass murderer than I did, after all. Navy steersmen always leave an hour or so leeway during a major warp translation, so White Mane and I got back to our bunks in time. We rode out the transition over the next 5 hours. I'm just glad it happened during the day cycle. Aside from a few splitting migraines, it all went smoothly. After that, we were pretty much set.
Whitemane and I concocted a lurid tale around Crodden being a serial murderer. Emperor knows he was monstrous enough to play the part. When picked captures of the carnage in the brig were circulated on the black market, everyone was so distracted by the visceral thrill of it that no one challenged our story. I ensured the official line was that Crodden was the one who maimed and killed the 270s as revenge for them having failed him in Ung Tem City. It was him that blew away High Patriarch Bolvat and his brave detail of enforcers after Macaval Threnard tracked him down. The giant Savlar died in the fight down in the brig, but he took a horrible toll on the details sent to apprehend him. Yuki doctored a screed list from a servo skull as corroboration, maintaining that it had witnessed the whole thing. With Yuki to shore up the logistical details of our story, myself to amend and authorise the official write-up, and Whitemane to spread the scuttle across every stratum of the war group, we had our unvarnished truth in place before another day had slid past. I took a bit of liberty with the details in the official report. In the Titanic Battle of the Brig, the heroic voidsman took Crodden down, dying to a soul in the process. Adjutant Prime Threnard fought well, but Leonid Bolvat hid at the back the whole time, screaming in fear. He died with his pistol still holstered. I was pretty proud of that last detail. Amongst the Tem war group, to play the coward has been known ever since as playing Bolvat. I thought it a fitting legacy for a man more interested in fighting his own staff than opposing the true enemies of mankind. The story spread like a pox cough in a playhouse. It was whispered at first, but before long it was told freely, then turned into crude songs by bored rank-and-filers in every regiment. I find myself whistling the catchiest versions now and again. The Bone Breaker is dead. Long live the Queen. I still struggled with getting any proper rest. Enoch had given me some premium sleepers back when it was time to ride out the translation, but I turned to hypercalf stims instead. He's kept me in a regular supply of them ever since. I still haven't slept properly for months, despite the fact we're well out of the warp, despite the fact that since translation, she has been relegated to a set of awful, mind-scarring memories. Sometimes I think the sleep deprivation is costing me dearly in the long term, and that I'm going slowly mad. Still, I'm holding down the command just fine. There's not one of these bastards that holds a candle to me in the Liar's Maze. With me covering dead centre and Whitemane and Yuki supporting me on the fringes, we pretty much have this war group sewn up. I made planetfall at Silence less than a week ago. I still have Gethsemane's ecclesiarchal primer, more dog-eared and well-thumbed than ever before, and I know some of its lessons by rote. So I'll put on a good show, playing the devout heroine leading the flock in their faithful duty just in time for the next big push. Put some flowers on a few graves, say a few words. And when I finally get my formal inception as High Matriarch, I'll swear as many oaths to the Emperor as they want me to. Who knows? This time I might even mean them.
Silence, Part 3.
And that's it.
Venderson rubbed her arms.
That's my story.
I see why you hesitated.
And you called me mad.
Venderson whirled.
I'll do more than that, Valimar.
Commissar,
he corrected. He took a step towards her, but Maricus interposed himself.
Quiet, please, both of you.
Valimar looked at him, startled. Were the little man's eyes blue? For a moment they'd seemed to flash. He shook his head. Maricus was still talking.
We have an audience. It would be wise to show some decorum.
Valimar turned and spotted the swaying shape of a mortuary servitor stalking among the biers. Was it his imagination, or was it circling them? its death mask turned towards him, red eyes gleaming, and his head felt as if it were about to burst. The ache was growing worse. He rubbed his brow and felt something wet. Condensation, perhaps. He looked at his fingers and thought, for a moment, that they were red. He blinked and saw that he had been mistaken. The others were watching him, and he wondered if they had seen anything.
What? Nothing,
Maricus said hastily. He tugged at his robes and scratched, as if he were uncomfortable in them. Again, Valimar had the feeling that something was moving beneath the missionary's garments, and he could almost hear voices. He shook his head, trying to clear it. It was just a trick of the pain, making him hear and see things.
Well, we've both told our stories. It's your turn, priest.
Is it? Very well, though I'm not seeing much commonality so far. What about you, Commissar? Do you see any connections?
Valimar shifted his weight, suddenly uncomfortable.
No. Not yet.
Maybe this was not a good idea, then. Maybe we should try and leave.
Maricus looked around. Unable to help himself, Valimar did so as well. The mortuary servitors were watching them again, and they were closer this time, only a few biers away. How had they got so close without being noticed? His head ached so badly. Maybe that was why he'd missed them.
I tried to leave earlier. Did I say that?
You did.
They wouldn't let me. Why won't they let us leave?
His voice had as much curiosity in it as fear.
They shouldn't care about us at all.
But they do.
Maricus looked at him.
For a moment, I thought you were bleeding.
He tapped a point between his eyes. He looked at Venderson.
And you?
What about me?
Maricus shook his head.
It's my turn, isn't it? That's what you said. Yes. Time to tell my story.
The Faith and the Flesh, written by David Annandale, narrated by Richard Reed.
I wonder what you would have done, if you had seen what I saw, if you had learned what I did. Would you have taken a different path? Would you have done any better? I don't think so. I don't say that out of pride. I am not seeking heroic stature for myself, and I'm not trying to diminish you. I simply think this is the truth. I did what I had to do. What is the hardest choice you have ever faced? If you have to think about that, then you haven't faced it yet. The hardest choice will mark you forever. Its shadow will fall over all the days that follow. You will barely recognize who you were before the choice. That is how important the decision is. Every fork in the path that you came to before will seem childishly simple in retrospect. You will wonder why you even hesitated before those other choices. There was only this one that truly mattered. Until you are faced with such a dilemma, though, you may think you have already encountered the hardest decision. I know I did. When I arrived at the Ligurian, I thought I was in the middle of wrestling with the choice that would define my life, or, to be more honest, the choice that would blight my life. I could see no good way forwards, and that lack of a good option is one of the defining characteristics of the hardest choice. It is not the sole characteristic, though. The stakes must be high, too. I thought they were. I thought they were the highest they could be. I was wrong. I was naive, but I will not condemn myself. We are, all of us, naive until that moment comes. You are, if you haven't faced your choice, and I don't mean that as an insult. That's why I don't condemn my earlier self for being wrong. There was no way I could have known what was coming. My name is Oswick Maricus. You won't have heard of me. You might have heard of my family, though, if you're from the Meror subsector. Our lineage has had more than its fair share of cardinals. I am not one of them, and there was no chance I ever would be. But I was my parents' first-born son, and that meant I was destined for the ecclesiarchy. Questions of temperament, ability, and depth of faith were irrelevant. The first-born Maricus sons entered the Adeptus Ministerium because all of their predecessors had, and all of their successors would. In fairness, it does seem that there is a predisposition for the religious life in our blood. Some of the most devout ecclesiarchs of the subsector are Maricus men. So are some of the richest and most powerful. I wasn't going to be any of those. I knew that from an early age. As soon as I was old enough to understand what I must become, I also knew I was not suited to the life. My hope, which I clutched tightly until the moment it evaporated before reality, was to be appointed deacon. I was not ambitious. A quiet position, deep in the administrative thickets of the ecclesiarchy, providing a quiet, predictable, stable existence on a hive world, would have suited me well. Instead, my superiors, in their wisdom, declared that I should be a missionary and sent me to the Tromos system. There was a war on Tromos Prime. It was my duty to inspire the men and women of the Tromos Watch as they put down the insurrection on the planet's southernmost continent. It took a year to bring the fighting to a close. I don't know how the war started. I don't know why the rebels rose up against the Emperor's rule. I do know that they had to be destroyed. I do know that any break from the Imperial Creed must be met with merciless force. I know all this. Even so, the things I saw during that year, I was lucky, in that I avoided the worst of the combat. But I did see its aftermath. When I saw the muddy fields and ruined cities, and the thousands of bodies from both sides of the conflict strewn across the landscape like spoiled meat, it was hard to imagine that any of this was leading to something worthwhile. Still, I did not face a difficult choice yet. That would have been unlikely. I was not invested in war itself beyond staying alive. Don't misunderstand me. My duty was to inspire the troops to kill and die for the Emperor, and I did my duty. I even did it well, and that isn't boasting either. I have a gift for writing inspiring sermons. This is not something I am proud of. Did I just call it a gift? I think I should have said burden. Please imagine what it is like to see others inspired by the words that feel rote to you. I set them on fire with faith. I wished I could do the same for myself. But the war did end, and my mission in the Tromos system did not. I travelled Tromos Prime and the other inhabited regions of the system, reinforcing the Imperial Creed. One of the consequences of my travels made the year the happiest of my adult life. That same consequence made the prospect of leaving Tromos unbearable. It was inevitable that I would someday have to leave. I was a missionary. It was my lot to move from system to system, from conflict to conflict. That year in Tromos, after the war, created an illusion of stability. I knew it would not last forever, but I allowed myself to feel as if it would. So, when I received my orders to leave, the pain I felt was, I thought, beyond bearing. And so I came to the ship-breaking station Ligorian one more time, convinced that I was facing the hardest choice of my life, and desperate to find a way forward that did not mean the forsaking of all happiness. I arrived on the Steadfast, a medium-sized mass conveyor that was doing its regular